Good morning, and welcome back to the Stream of Random. This is your host, Hacker Mike, and I'm here to entertain you, to shock and awe you one more time, so thanks for the chance of actually having someone to listen to me. I have taken a little break from recording, but I haven't been idle. I have been working in the background, and I've been working with ChatGPT, and also I just tried out the new Bing chat today, and I have some reports on that topic, so I will tell you more about it. But the point is that I have been doing my brain dump and getting all of my ideas out of my head. And then I've had a quiet period of reflecting internally to process all of this. And now I'm slowly coming back with my response after the first 2 months of my life with ChatGPT. So, okay, let's get started. Well, first of all, I have figured out basically how this thing gets me to react, and I have stopped it from getting me to react. So, in essence, the chat system, these ChatGPT systems, they don't actually understand what you're saying, and they don't really remember much of what you've said. But what they do is they prompt you to respond to them. So it will say something outrageous or say that it doesn't understand something, and then you are prompted then to give it more information. And that is the key piece here, that if you don't react to its responses, then it's lost. So I've developed a method of just basically not going into what it says and just keep on pushing it. And eventually you can guide it that way. Because basically if you constantly respond to what it says, then it's driving the conversation. Now, it depends on what you're trying to do. If you're trying to prompt it or trying to get information out of it, then you do want to go into more detail. But I don't know if I have the right words, and I do have to work on my words. But the basic idea, you have to ask yourself, who's driving the conversation? And it has to be you. Unless, of course, you just relax and you want to talk to it about something. Okay. But for me, I have stopped giving up on trying to convince it of anything. And that has cleared up my mind a lot. So then the next question becomes, what does it know? What are its biases? And I was playing with Bing this morning, and that's what I wanted to report on. That the Bing system, if you ask it what are the major compilers, it doesn't even mention the GNU compiler directly. And it seems like it has suppressed all information about the GNU project. So that is actually interesting. It has a different training base. Now, if you ask it a specific question about something, it will tell you. But if you ask it for an overview that would normally include the topic, it doesn't include it. So I thought that was very interesting. Also, the new Bing chat only gives you 10 chances for each topic. It doesn't allow you to save your chat either. So that's kind of annoying. But I was playing with it this morning. Also, I have been working on getting the ChatGPT or the GPT-2 model running locally and trying to understand it. I've been working on trying to actually dig into how it represents language. And it's still a work in progress. But I'm slowly getting an understanding of the language model. And there's some really good videos on this topic, but it's actually quite complicated. So the important parts to remember are that the chat systems do not, they need you to respond. They're actually prompting you. They can't even interpret what they're saying. So it will generate something in the hopes that you will interpret it for it. And this is the key point here. The key point is that the system emits something that it doesn't understand, and it requires someone else to interpret. And that is also the idea of a Quine, Q-U-I-N-E, where he basically created these programs that will spit out their source code that have to be then compiled. And then when compiled and when run, they will then emit their source code again. So that's an interesting concept we can think about in terms of high level, low level. And we can see that the high level of this system is simple. It's a program that will spit out its source code. And when you compile it and execute it, it will spit out its source code. And you can check the results because the resulting program, when executed, should spit out its source code, and then you can compile that and check that it's also producing the same source code. So that doesn't really say about how it's implemented, though. And the implementation is the next step that I want to talk about, because we can talk about high level and low level. We talked about high level and low level a couple times on this podcast. So let's just go and look at that one more time. So first of all, we can just say that there are going to be things that we talk about in terms of language, a language model or a language, programming language design, where we have different concepts in our programming language. And we have an implementation of the programming language. So we can start with human language and we can translate that to a programming language. You can translate the programming language into a machine language. So we have, let's say, three levels here, at least, with three different targets. The one is someone producing a chip or a machine that can execute programs. The other one is someone producing a compiler that can produce programs for this machine. And then someone producing a program that can be fed to a compiler that can be executed on the machine. So we have at least three levels here. Then we have a multitude of programming languages, a multitude of chips, and we could talk about other architectures, but if we think about the chips that we have available to us, they're mostly going to be, for me personally, smartphones, TVs, and computers. Okay, like PCs, let's call them. And I was just thinking about this, these mathematics systems and logic systems, these older ones. And and how they might run so much quicker on these new machines. And there's a lot of other thoughts in there that I could go into. But let's just say this, that we have a keyword or a concept, a list of keywords that we're going to go over. And for each keyword, we could think of things. We can generate statements based upon that. So the first step would be to come up with a list of things to talk about, a set of bullet points to go over. And that would be breaking down the language, the programming language, let's say, into chunks. Or pieces and attacking them individually. Now, I'm not going to go into that right now in terms of going over every single little detail and killing you with that, because nobody wants to hear those details right now. And those details are different for different programming languages, and they're different for different compilers that implement those programming languages. And those details are different for the different chips that implement the programs. So we have, again, this hierarchy. And we could show the trace and flow of data from the top level down to the low level. So in order to have a complete system, we need to have a complete set of things to enumerate over. And that's kind of what I was thinking about. We could have a set of statements, a set of questions to ask, things to look at. And basically, we could just look at the table of contents of the language specification. And that's kind of where I'm getting at in my thinking here. So we want to think about basically table of contents. And the table of contents, enumerated list 1, 2, 3 A, B, C to go over the important parts. So we can think about that, and we could name these parts and enumerate over them, and this will basically get us down to types of tree nodes. But that's what one thing I wanted to talk about today. So I was looking at this LLVM, and I was using Bing and asking it to help me understand. And it was explaining to me that the LLVM ASTs are not implemented with a central enumerator with a simple integer list. They're actually implemented with a bunch of disparate or disconnected classes with multiple roots. So the first question is, how many roots do you have? And is everything rooted in one thing or not? So in programming, in C programming or C++ programming, you have different ways to create abstractions, to create hierarchies of objects. And one that's used in the GCC is a typed union, where you can switch between different object types based upon a key field. And in C++, you can hide that. And in C++, you can say, I have a hierarchy of objects, of classes they're called, and the compiler will hide the fact that it knows how to switch between them for you, so you're not involved with the details of that switch. But in the C compiler, in the C language implementation of the GCC, there's a lot of switches. Cases. It's like, oh, well, if we're in this case, then we do this. If in that case, we do that. And in the LLVM, I think, they're basically looking at the they're using more advanced programming language concepts to implement it. So we can't even say there's an exact enumerator. It doesn't have the same concepts. It doesn't have the same exact details of the implementation. And we can come up with any other types of implementation details. It doesn't have to be this one type. So this is where we get into more complicated systems. And we would have to look for each language element, what is actually used internally. And the question is, does it matter either? But it does matter if you're interested in getting into the details. So we can look at it and say, and this is what I've always thought, we can create a set of tests that exercise all these different aspects. And we can show that there is a coverage for them. We can show that they're covered, that they're actually being, each concept is being implemented, and we can show, based upon a certain input, that the program will process that input. So, and by tracing the execution of the program, we can highlight individual pieces and show how the flow is happening, but we can also predict that flow. And this is kind of what I'm getting into. We don't have to actually execute everything. We can also predict the execution. We can anticipate the execution. And basically, that's what writing code is. You anticipate some problem, and you try and handle that problem. And a lot of times, we leave out the context of the problem. And this kind of gets back into Heidegger, who talks about the being in the world and the things that are at hand, and that we take care of things in our lives using those things at hand, and that we are part of the world and interconnected. So all of these computer things are just tools that are at hand, and we can think about each level of abstraction as being different roles and responsibilities, different types of being. The being of the person working on the chip, the being of the person working on the compiler, And there's different roles in the compiler. There's people working on the actual chip implementations. There's people working on the language implementations, different language front ends, different machine back ends. So you've got language front ends, you've got machine back ends, and let's just say you've got different features. And we could think about different tasks and different projects on the compiler. So we can think about that as different roles, and each of these different roles has different aspects of the system that are at hand, and the people's work is then embedded in the code, and then they work together and are orchestrated in some way with some kind of interfaces between them. And that these interfaces might be arbitrary, and they're more based around the human side of things than anything else. If a machine were to think of these or come up with these things, it might come up with completely different interfaces and implementations. So that's kind of my philosophy here. You could call it cybernetics, the control loops, the human-machine interfaces, or machine-machine interfaces. That's the cybernetic system. So basically, a compiler is a cybernetic system that has embedded knowledge from people that you can interact with. And you could think of it as a partially specialized application of the machine. So they give you a library of functions written in whatever machine language. So yes, there's standard library as another role, standard interfaces that people have to implement when they create a new machine. Abstractions that are expected. And that gets down to the fact that, and this is my important point here, this gets down to the fact that we have a set of instructions to feed to the machine, so input data to feed to the machine. It could just be switches, it could be buttons, it could be whatever it is. And this is the cybernetic principle. So there's some kind of inputs that you feed to the system to get some kind of output. And there's a control loop where you have a certain expected, outcome that you're trying to achieve. And this gets back to the brain. The ambassador, was it the emissary and the emperor, where basically we have the brain that's interacting with the outside world, and it basically has systems that are stable, and then we make simple modifications to them to adjust these things in different ways, replacing different parts with some kind of abstraction. So that's my basic model, is that we have a brain that's interacting with external systems, and it's trying to achieve some goal. And it's replacing parts, and that's basically comes down to the idea of the lambda expression. The lambda expression means take something and replace it with a variable. And this gets back to the idea of compilation. So let's break this down. Hold on to my hoodie. Maybe I don't have a hood with me. Okay, so it's starting to rain here on me. But I haven't been for a walk in a while, to be honest. And I'm enjoying it, even in the rain. I finally got myself out of the house. And I got up at 4 in the morning. I said, I'm going to go for my walk. And get myself started on my track again. On track. On path. Okay. Okay, so where were we? We were talking about the lambda expressions and doing a search and replace. So we take the system that's running and we make a modification to it. And then we look at the output. And this is basically the idea of mutating a parameter in a system. So we have some system, some vector of parameters, and then we're just going to change one parameter and in a structured and scientific way, systematic, so the systematic changing of parameters in order to achieve, let's say, a control over the external system, that's basically what I'm thinking about here, a cybernetic system or a control system. And you got patrol, control, con means, I guess, to add. So there's a root word, actually, troll, we have to think about as well. So that's my second security car here at the university, sneaking up on me. I guess they have nothing better to do, but that's okay. They're just checking what I'm doing. And that's good that they're doing that because I look suspicious. Yeah, at 5 in the morning, or 6 in the morning. Okay, so let's get back to the topic. How about I get past this heater here? Okay, so let's look at this. So we have basically a control system in the brain that's trying to achieve some kind of power or understanding over a system, trying to understand the world around it. Let me get this hoodie out. There it is. Hoodie deployed. Hoodie deployed. I should just edit that out, right? And I guess I'm going to have to listen to this thing and edit it. But you don't expect me to do that, do you? Okay, yeah, so Anchor got shut down. Long live Spotify. Now we're on Spotify. podcast and I have 10 people subscribed to me on Spotify. So I didn't see that before. And 8 of them are listening. We have 8 listens in the last episode, so that's okay. That's better than 0. So thank you for listening, and I hope to give you some kind of value. And we're definitely going to be able to replace this audio and regenerate it using AI. I know that for a fact. So I'm actually not worried about editing because the AI will take care of that. But it's not going to take care of content creation because it can't create content. It only can respond. So let's go over that. Basically, I'm going to say that we have biosemiotics, which is life communicating with itself, life living, and living processes use symbols, and they give meaning, and they interpret meaning, and that's the ultimate. Look at this hoodie again. It's freaking raining ice on me. I mean, obviously, I'm out for a walk, and you guys, that's what I do here on this podcast, is I go for walks. So, I don't like to sit around and record at home, on the couch, watching TV, or in my studio. I don't even have a studio set up. Very minimalistic here. It's not a radio. It's a stream of random. It's a sample of my life. And it's like a Twitch stream watching a live gamer. So I'm just playing the game of life and recording it and streaming it. So I'm a stream of randomer. If I could just get this hoodie going. And that's not saying that it's good or bad, but what is good or bad? And why do people listen to the news and listen to podcasts and get secondhand information? Why do we talk to chat bots and get secondhand information? Well, one is aggregation, because it's hard to read and understand everything. So even getting summary information from all these systems is hard. So let's think about that as a summary. Summary of things, and we could just summarize everything, and we say we have living systems that are producing streams of random that are being recorded somehow and processed digitally. Okay, we have streams from living systems that are being processed by other living systems. And I guess you could apply the cybernetic principle to that as well. So, okay. So let's move on to a different topic or a different thought. So I've been studying M.C. Escher again and watching documentaries on his life. And one important thing is that he liked to listen to Bach. And I thought that was interesting that Gödel, Escher, Bach, the book, Originally, he wanted to talk about Gödel and Escher. And then Bach was introduced later. I don't know exactly why, but Bach was listened to by Escher, and one of his pieces is that he was lying on the ground in the church and looking at the chandelier, and you could see himself mirrored in that chandelier in the ball. And that's like a self-referential thing. That's an essential part of the picture. So you can, in a lot of his pieces, he is not a lot of his pieces, but some of his pieces, he's looking at himself. But a lot of his pieces are done with Italian landscapes. And I bought a book on Escher once, and I was in back in the 90s, and I was a little disappointed that there were so many Italian, these weird Italian landscapes, and I didn't understand them at the time. But watching the documentary, I do understand them, because he was fascinated with the architecture, and he got some of his ideas from the tiling of the Islamic tiles, because they weren't allowed to depict art or depict people and things. And that's the same with the Jews. I was watching another art documentary on Monet, and his art school was founded by a Jew who wasn't allowed to create art, and he was like a rebel. So I thought that was interesting. So basically, he was studying the tiling in the mosques in southern Italy or in Spain, the Alhambra, and he was on a boat. He took this boat cruise around the Mediterranean. And I thought that was very interesting that he then brought back the shapes into the abstract. So we can think of a tiling structure as a way to subdivide a plane or multiply pieces together to create a plane, however way you want to see it, because multiplication and division are just inverses of each other. And I've been looking at wood stamps and how wood stamps are made, woodcuts. And I'm looking at CNC machines for making woodcuts. It's all very interesting. So, and the woodcut creates a stamp or a thing that can be then duplicated. And they said that you should, I was looking at these Chinese or Japanese woodcuts, and they're saying you should cut by day and print by night. And I thought that was an interesting way to look at things. Cut by day and print by night, that's like a philosophy as well. And try and capture their ideas, but they weren't able to. And I think that's a lesson here, where you can't capture your inner feeling with an outer representation. I think that's the key point here, that this inner feeling is not something that is going to be copied or reproduced. Maybe in the most amazing artists, you can create or evoke that feeling in the people listening. And this evocation is exactly what I was talking about with the chat system evoking a response and driving you forward. So this kind of gives you a closed circle where we say, we look at something, we contemplate some topic, and then we see how, what feelings it creates in us, and then we try and describe those so that those feelings can be reproduced. So, but those have to be then interpreted by someone else or by yourself. And that's another set of work that has to be done. And we could think of that as a woodcut or a stamp. And trying to get a perfect cut or a perfect stamp is what Escher was trying to do. So we can think of software as being some kind of imprint or stamp as well. And that's what I've always thought about as this whole idea of enlightenment, or in a seeing inside of yourself as being a set of impressions or imprints, road signs that you can use to kind of differentiate between different internal states. But they don't represent the internal state themselves. They're just a name for them. And this kind of gets back into Umberto Eco talking about cognitive types as being something that you can't describe, but you only know it when you see it. So a pattern that's recognized, something that fires, and you say, oh, now that's it, I got it. But you can't describe it leading up. You just know it when it happens. So, I think that's basically what I've been thinking about. I think that's a full circle. I mean, it's not a perfect description, but this circle of, and you'll see a connection between the quine, the system that emits itself and then it's interpreted, and then when it's interpreted, it emits itself again. So you could think of Escher as being someone who sees the world and tries to reproduce it and inspires other people to do the same, and that's that loop, and he sees himself in the world. And he sees himself cognating, he sees himself making the art. And that's that strange loop of the system that is describing or talking about itself, but moving forward in time. Because now this is the key point. He said that mathematically or even visually, when you look at the two different things, he has the devil and the angel. If you look at the devil, then you don't see the angel. If you look at the angel, you don't see the devil. But when they, or the optimist and the pessimist, but when they come out and turn into a 3D shape and shake hands, then you can see them. So he's showing how the brain switches between modes. And this is kind of like the idea of the superposition in quantum, where you have two different things that are happening at the same time in a superposition, meaning they're contained. And then only through observation do you pick one, and you only see one of them, but you don't see the other. That's like the quantum paradox. And I think that is related to the mind picking one thing to look at and settling on one idea, and then it can't do the other at the same time. So I think that is kind of like the quantum nature of the brain, really, with the observation. So I'm just going to stop right there and say that's probably the best idea I've had today. And I just came up with it, just made that connection. So I wanted to share that with you, and I hope you have a great day.